MechCast, Friday, December 26th, 2014. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How are you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, we're getting to our last couple of shows for 2014. We're going to be finishing out and looking forward to 2015. I hope you had an awesome, happy, and safe holiday season. I hope you got all of the things that you want, including fresh new Apple gear, maybe some iPads, iPhones, maybe a shiny new Retina 27-inch iMac. There wasn't one of those under my Christmas tree, although I wish there probably was. We're due for a new desktop Mac, but I'm not sure I can shell out the cash just yet. Our trusty 2010 seems to be chugging along, and we keep it going, and it seems to work okay. But we're due for a new one, I think, here soon. And I hope maybe you got some new gear and are enjoying that. But got lots of things to talk about in this episode of the MacCast. We're going to get into the whole BBC Panorama expose that cropped up last week, and there's lots of opinions flying back and forth. Of course, I'm going to share mine with you on that subject, and we're going to talk about what was in that report in case you missed it. Also, talking about iPhone sales over the holidays, that's looking to shape up pretty nicely for Apple. Some new updates to the ABC app on Apple TV, and we're going to get into Apple Pay and check in with how adoption on Apple Pay is working out this season for Apple. And then getting back into some of the things we were talking about on the last episode of the MacCast with adware and spyware, how to maybe identify some of that stuff and remove it if you've been hit by that. A few of you have been giving me some reports that that's cropping up more this holiday season. I'm not really sure why. We have a question about using a silent alarm in iOS. And then I received a really interesting question about iTunes gifts. You know how you have the ability to gift an app or a song or something in iTunes? There was a question that cropped up related to that that we're going to get into in this episode. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into that, a couple things I want to mention. One, I kind of missed a MacCast anniversary, and a pretty significant one that I should have probably talked about on the last episode. But the MacCast has now been running for 10 years. The very first episode of the MacCast was December 13th. I believe, hopefully I'm getting my history right, December 13th, 2004. So we just passed 10 years, 510 regular episodes. That doesn't include some of the special episodes, as well as it does not include the member episodes of the MacCast. So a lot of episodes, a lot of years. I have had the great pleasure of being able to bring the MacCast to you. And so I just wanted to say thank you for listening. Thank you for continuing to support the show. And I look forward to doing another 10 years. As long as you'll keep listening, I plan to keep on producing the MacCast. So we'll be here for a long, long time. And it's been a fun run and a lot of great times over the years. And so we'll get into the show here in a minute, but before we do, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, also a sponsor that's been with the MacCast for many, many years, and we're happy to have them on board because I love their products. It's Smile Software, and this month I want to talk to you about PDF Pen Scan Plus. It's a complete mobile scanning and OCR application for your iPhone, for your iPad. What I love about it is it makes it so simple. It has one-touch scanning directly into your device. You can scan a single document. You can scan multiple pages into a single document, which is really convenient. And it kind of handles everything for you. It will detect the page edges automatically. It will automatically crop your scan. You can do little adjustments to make sure that it fits right in there. And then once you've scanned it in, it does OCR, optical character recognition, and converts the scan into a searchable PDF, which for me is key because it's going to go into either PDF Pen or maybe it's going to go into Goodreader, some system where I'm going to archive it and need to come back and look for that stuff. And searching is key. And one nice thing about the OCR now in PDF Pen Scan Plus is it's performed right in app. So doesn't have to go out to a cloud service. You don't need to rely on an internet connection. And then you can preview, you can copy that text, that OCR text out and get that into another document. So if you need to load portions of it into an email, that makes that really convenient. And you can also automatically upload and save your scans into cloud storage. So if you want to throw it into Dropbox or into iCloud, all of that support is there. And the latest version of the app, PDF Pen Scan Plus 1.5, improves the camera layout. They've also added in image stabilization so that you'll be able to take nice, clean scans of your images. And it has full support for Apple's new iCloud Drive in OS X Yosemite. So you should check it out. Head over to smilesoftware.com. You can get all the details or just look for PDF Pen Scan Plus in the App Store. Also, check out all of Smile's other apps while you're over at the website. And a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Right off the bat at the top of the show, we're going to get into a pretty heavy topic, and that is the BBC program Panorama. They ran this expose on the working conditions in a Pegatron factory. Pegatron is one of Apple's suppliers, if you remember, and they shined a pretty harsh light on Apple and called into question their ability to be able to protect workers' rights, specifically at their suppliers. If you remember a few years back, you know, Apple was called to task on this. Tim Cook came out publicly and said they were going to work very hard to do a better job, that they would provide oversight. They worked with some third-party outside organizations to go in and do audits and things like that. And so this was sort of the first report from a news organization that really dove in once again and looked at, you know, factory conditions. And they basically sent in some undercover agents, some representatives that I think got hired by Pegatron. They had undercover video cameras and they captured conditions at the factory. And this was one of the factories that was responsible for iPhone 6 assembly. And what they discovered was numerous infractions to the country's working conditions and guidelines and also to Apple's own supplier code of conduct. They were doing things like confiscating IDs, which is illegal, but they'd have the workers come in, they would take their ID cards, and the idea here was is that forces them to stay at the factory because within China, you have to have an ID card on you at all times. So without that, you know, they're kind of held hostage, which is just horrible. And also, they noted excessive working hours, workers having to sleep on the job, sleep between breaks because they were so tired, poor living conditions, also incidents of underage workers, all of these things that we've heard in the past and things that Apple has been actively working to combat at their factories. And Apple does have their own supplier code of conduct that sort of outlines and states different guidelines for Apple suppliers, things like overtime needs to be voluntary. But what was shown in the reporting was something that made it look very much like overtime was not voluntary, that these workers were being forced into it. And in addition to focusing on Pegatron, the main supplier, the report also went into some of the second and third tier suppliers, basically their source material suppliers for things like tin. They showed a mine in Indonesia that was using children to dig ore out of these muddy pools by hand. To me, what it looks like is the way they mine this stuff is they basically blast a hill with water. The water, mud, sludge, whatever, washes down into these pools, and then the workers have to go into these pools and by hand sort of scoop out and collect tin. And it's highly dangerous. There's been reports and incidents of miners and workers getting buried. And, of course, you don't want children in that kind of situation, but they showed one boy who looked to be maybe around 9 years old. It was just horrific, horrific conditions. The things that we don't like to think about when we think about our electronics products. And the things that we hope companies are working actively to fight and avoid. And the thing is that I think Apple is one of those companies that is doing that as much as they can. But this is a really, really big issue, and it's complex. And the thing about reports like this one from the BBC is that they go in and they focus on one company and they focus on specific incidents, but they don't give a larger or a broader picture, I don't think, about what's going on and what various companies, Apple and others, are doing. You know, they mainly highlighted Apple in this and said Apple has a huge problem and that Apple's doing, they implied that Apple was doing very little to help change or stop this. And I don't think that's really an accurate thing to be saying. To me, what the report did show was that companies like Pegatron were going to what I consider to be excessive lengths to try and hide their activities from Apple. The reality is that Apple is doing more than any other company, and I think they made some public statements to the fact in response to this reporting. They're doing more than most companies to try and hold suppliers and partners accountable and try and impact change, try and make sure these kinds of things, these kinds of violations don't continue to happen. Some of the things that Apple does do and continues to do more and more is audit their direct suppliers, but they're also auditing those second and third tier suppliers. So companies that they're not even working with directly, but that their suppliers are working with. As a matter of fact, if you go in and look at their reports, and they actually put these out every year, something that a lot of other companies don't do. This past year, Apple performed 451 audits across their supply chain, and they used not only their auditors, but also third-party auditors to take out any kind of bias. And they also commission independent audit reports from the Fair Labor Association, and then they disclose the results of all of that publicly. You can go to Apple's supplier responsibility website, and you can pull these up, and you can see incidents of violations that they found. You can see what they're doing to work with their vendors and suppliers to try and correct the situation. Now, obviously, when you look at a report like what the BBC did, they have further to go. But the point is that they're trying, and I think that is key here, and that's something that was left out of the reporting. I also feel that Apple is making more of an impact by actually being a presence in these companies. It feels like a lot of times when these reports come out that what people want Apple to do is completely pull out of using any of these suppliers. And at the end of the day, it's not really realistic, because another thing that's not mentioned in the report at all is that these suppliers are the same ones that Apple's competitors are using. And these are the suppliers that Apple has to use in order to continue to be competitive. If they were to pull out and start manufacturing someplace else, someplace where there's more oversight, more rigid standards via government or however that is, they would not be able to compete. And Apple has kind of two people to serve. Yes, they want to serve the rights of their workers at their suppliers and things like that. They're also beholden to their shareholders. And if they started acting in a way that wasn't in the best interest of the shareholders, they would get sued to oblivion and probably go out of business. And if Apple's out of business and if they're not working with these partners and suppliers, then they can't have things like their code of conduct. They can't be doing those audits. They can't be going into those companies and trying to impact or enforce change. So pulling out of those companies would take away a lot of the policing and monitoring, because Apple's doing that stuff and a lot of those competitors aren't, and those competitors continue to use those suppliers and ramp up orders. So it is a very complex situation, and I don't think you can make these cut and dry black and white sort of arguments when doing these things. And so it's good that these reports come out and that we have these conversations, but it really is a multi-level issue. Companies need to work to affect change, but it can't just be companies. It can't just be Apple working alone. There also needs to be involvement, I think, from social organizations, from human rights organizations, and there are, and governments also need to do more. It will take the World Trade Organization, companies like Apple, the United States government, all of these people getting involved to really impact and implement meaningful and, I think, long-term change. But the point is I think that at least Apple is trying. Now, for its part, Pegatron came back and claimed that it's going to inspect all of the negative claims carried out in the report by the BBC, and that they're going to implement improvements to make sure that the problems are resolved. But I really think in a lot of ways that's lip service, because what, again, the video does show is they show Pegatron actually acting in a way to kind of circumvent some of Apple's guidelines. And I hope Apple comes back and does some sort of penalties against Pegatron, or at least has some continued meetings, or steps up their audits of Pegatron after seeing this report. And I think that they will. You know, they're claiming that they're providing strict training to both their management and their workers, but then in this video they show that one of the tests that Apple makes them impose to make sure that workers aren't too tired to work on lines, they're actually feeding the answers to the workers so that they will pass and so that they can get certified to actually go in and work when maybe they shouldn't be. And those are the kinds of unsafe working conditions that Apple is working actively to stop. And Apple is going to continue to get singled out for this kind of thing because they're one of the top manufacturers in the world working with these companies. There are other big ones out there, and I think maybe some of these exposés should be focusing on them, because I think they're not working as hard as Apple. But the other thing that's good is I think Apple's not afraid of being the company that's being singled out, because they know that they're working hard to effect change, and they can point to examples and say, look at what we're doing, look at this, see how we're working to make a change and make an impact and make sure that this gets better. What are you doing? So they're happy to kind of take up that charge and mantra. I don't think they're afraid of it. And I think, you know, backing down or backing out would not be the way that they would want to act. And it's not the way that they act, right? They're going to stick it out. They're going to work hard, and they're going to continue to try and make this better. And I think that's the best thing that a company could do. So even though it looks bad when some of these reports come out, I was very happy to see how Apple responded and reacted to this, and to say, hey, we're not going away, we're not backing down, and we're going to work to try and make things better. I think that's the right thing for companies to be doing in this kind of situation. Let's switch over to something a little bit more positive for Apple. That's going to be their iPhone sales numbers over the holidays, which are shaping up to be quite nice, at least according to Apple Insider. They mentioned a report from Morgan Stanley, or a survey rather, that predicts that Apple could break their all-time quarterly sales record for iPhones, assuming that they've been able to keep up with the demand. Morgan Stanley says that Apple could report sales as high as 67 million units for the holiday quarter. That would be quite a bit higher than some other analysts in Wall Street are predicting. So far, we've seen ranges of 62 to 63 million, so that's about 4 million more units than some of the others. But even if you look at the lower numbers, Apple would handily break last year's quarterly unit sales record, which was 51 million iPhones sold for the holiday quarter. And it's looking like they could do it, because shipping times and stock on Apple's iPhone 6 models had improved in the months going into the holiday buying season. There also seems to continue to be very high demand, which are both good signs that Apple should have a really great holiday quarter. As a matter of fact, Piper Jaffray conducted a survey of 1,004 U.S. smartphone consumers who plan to purchase a new device in the next 3 months, and half of them claimed that they would be purchasing a new iPhone. So fully expect that when Apple announces the numbers from the holiday quarter, that they are going to be very good when it comes to iPhone. As far as who's buying those products, Apple continues to be a top brand among college students. In a somewhat limited survey of 880 college students, the book-selling website Chegg found that 51% of students that they talked to said they preferred Apple-branded smartphones, tablets, and laptops. That is over Samsung devices, which came in second at about 30%. And they also found that students preferred Apple's new brand Beats for their headphones. 46% said that was their top pick for headphones. So Apple's brand continues to be pretty strong among college-aged consumers. And I don't think any of us find that too surprising. And then looking kind of toward the future, Piper Jaffray took a look at Apple's Apple Watch and found that consumers are being a little bit cautious about what Apple might bring to market, mainly because a lot of us don't have a lot of information about the Apple Watch. What they found was that just 7% of current iPhone owners say they plan to buy an Apple Watch when it comes out sometime in early 2015, although Gene Munster thinks that it's just simply consumers taking a wait-and-see approach because we don't have a lot of details, and that once Apple does finally have the Apple Watch out on the market and we start getting the reviews and things like that, that demand will go up. And even with the small predicted demand, it's still expected that Apple could sell up to 10 million units before the end of 2015. So I don't know, looking at those numbers, I think that would be a successful product. I don't know if that's a breakout hit like we saw with the iPhone or the iPad. But really at this point, you know, we're all just guessing because we don't know what the Apple Watch is finally going to be when it hits. We don't know about things like battery life, stuff like that. So once more and more of that information comes out and we get closer to a launch time, I think we'll get a little bit stronger numbers. But still, it's looking to be a pretty good product for Apple in 2015. And another product that could be pretty successful in 2015 would be a 12-inch Retina MacBook Air. Yep, that one's still being predicted for sometime in the first quarter of 2015. We're hearing reports that it's going to be manufactured by Quanta Computer. And as far as what it's going to look like, it's expected to be even slimmer and lighter than the current MacBook Air. Again, not too surprising. Apple always makes it slimmer and lighter, right? But it should feature Intel's newer chips, the Broadwell processors. And it's predicted that Apple will be able to get more thinness out of it by possibly eliminating the fan assembly that's in the current MacBook Airs or making the trackpad touch-enabled rather than having a physical click mechanism in it. And I guess those are two things that the reports I was reading said are responsible for the sort of thicker on one side, thinner on the other side profile of the MacBook Air. So by eliminating the fans and maybe taking off that click assembly, we might actually see something that is closer to the same thickness or thinness, rather, all the way across. And we had also heard previous rumors that the 12-inch Retina MacBook Air could bring with it a couple new color options, gold and space gray like we have in the iPhone and the iPad. I'm kind of lukewarm on. I don't know how I feel about that. Would you want different color options in your MacBook Air, your Retina MacBook Air? That may go back to some of my theories that Apple is going to kind of merge the 12-inch iPad Pro with a 12-inch Air, have some sort of hybrid option. I know my crazy harebrained theory, but why have a 12-inch iPad and a 12-inch Air as separate devices? I don't see a reason to have them be wholly separate, especially considering that a focus of the rumored iPad Pro is that it's going to have some sort of keyboard option or keyboard that goes along with it to make it more like a MacBook Air. So why have two separate things? Why can't they be somehow the same sort of thing? And Apple maybe has solved that problem of having this weird hybrid device. They're going to give us some reason or some way that this improves upon that whole concept and actually makes it viable where sort of other options has failed. Apple's great at doing that. And I think they could pull this off again. And it would give us a whole new form factor and move more and more folks into the post-PC era where you don't have a desktop or a formal notebook kind of computer. But we're going to have to wait and see in 2015 what Apple actually does. It's almost like one of my Christmas wishes came true because I think just a couple episodes ago, we were talking about the Apple TV and some new channels that Apple has added. And I expressed a little bit of my frustration that the route that Apple seemed to be taking with adding channels was in direct contradiction to my desire to actually cut the cord and not have a cable subscription, because so many of these additional channels require that you still have a cable subscription to be able to access most of the content. Well, this past week, ABC stepped up and they updated their iOS app as well as their Apple TV app. I think it's called Watch ABC. And it now allows you to view and access full-length episodes 1 week after they air without having to authenticate with your cable subscription. So you don't need a cable subscription to be able to access the content. If you do have a cable package, you get the added benefit of you can start streaming shows a day early. And they've also added in, if you have a cable subscription to the channel, live viewing options in certain markets: Chicago, Fresno, Houston, LA, New York, Philadelphia, Raleigh, Durham, and San Francisco. And I think they have plans to actually expand that over time, but those are the markets that are currently available. And in looking through it, I took a look because I was very excited to see them doing this. It looks like what they're doing is they're offering up the last five full episodes of a TV show that's currently, you know, in the current season. It doesn't go any back any further than that. So I was a little disappointed by that because I need to catch up on Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I think also I want to catch up on Once Upon a Time, but not going to be able to go back and do that without actually going into iTunes and maybe buying a season pass still. But you can get a week after it airs the most recent episode. So if you happen to miss it on TV, or you are a cord cutter like me, you'll be able to jump in and start watching those episodes. So I look forward to the next season. I'm bummed they didn't do this at the start of the season, that they're doing it now in mid-season. But you will be able to access that content, and it does look like there are ads. So it is ad-supported. You have to sit through a couple interstitial kind of ads when you're viewing the content. But I'm more than happy to do that in exchange for gaining access to the content and not having to do that whole stupid cable authorization that they make you do on the Apple TV. That's a big bonus to me. So I'm hoping that this becomes a popular option, that it works really well for ABC, and that maybe some of the other networks continue to follow suit and make their content available without actually having to have that package from a cable subscriber. I think that's going to be good for us cord cutters. I don't know about you, but I am already a big fan of Apple Pay. If you've had a chance to use Apple Pay, if you have an iPhone 6 or a 6 Plus, it is something that really does have that magical sort of feel. And according to a MarketWatch article that cited an investment research report, it looks like a lot of other people are enjoying Apple Pay as a mobile payment system, because their November numbers are in and it indicated that about 1% of all digital payment dollars were spent using Apple Pay. Now, that's pretty far behind some other more established services like Square, which came in with 18% of digital payment dollars, and PayPal with a whopping 78% of digital payment dollars. But it does show signs that consumers are rapidly adopting the new Apple Pay platform. You have to remember, Apple Pay is pretty limited in retail locations in terms of numbers. I think Apple has about 200,000 places that you can use Apple Pay, but that's really a small fraction, and it still is limited to those of us with newer iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus devices. And plus, it's only been around, you know, this study was for November purchases, so that's only really the first full month of Apple Pay. Apple Pay, I think, came out around mid-October. And what's more interesting in the numbers in this report is that it showed that 60% of Apple Pay customers, or customers that used Apple Pay, used it on multiple days throughout November, and that consumers, once they start using Apple Pay, are more apt to make more transactions or more purchases using Apple Pay. So the repeat rates and the transaction frequencies are above that of other payment systems, digital payment systems that are out there. As far as where people are using Apple Pay, the study showed that most of the time it's at Whole Foods. Whole Foods accounted for about 20% of all Apple Pay purchases in November. They were followed by Walgreens, which came in at 19%, and then McDonald's at 11%. And those were the three most popular locations for Apple Pay. Again, because these are some of the few retailers that have wide distribution and support for Apple Pay. There's others out there. I've used my Apple Pay at Home Depot. Works awesome and great. But then you go to other retailers, Lowe's, for example, and they don't accept it. So even if you wanted to use it there, you can't. And what it shows is that, you know, Apple has worked pretty hard at getting payment processor support and bank support for Apple Pay. We get reports that Apple's added new banks. They're adding smaller banks all the time. They have all the major credit card carriers already on board. But what they're having a harder time at getting is adoption rates at retail locations. Yes, 200,000 is a good start, but they need to have a lot more. It needs to be a lot more ubiquitous so that more and more of us can use it. And despite the early success, it looks like, again, Apple is having some trouble getting their partners up and running with Apple Pay. They made a small change to their partners' page language on their website. It used to say that certain partners were coming later this year. They recently changed that to say coming soon. So that would be for retail partners like Albertsons, Anthropology, Free People, Urban Outfitters, Walt Disney World, Starbucks, StubHub, Tickets.com, and Ticketmaster. Although Ticketmaster just added app support last week, so it looks like they did squeak in 2015. And Walt Disney World was supposed to go online with Apple Pay last week as well, and I think they did. So those two did still make it in 2015, but you know, we're running out of days and a lot of these other partners haven't come online. So it sounds like Apple's changing the language just to cover themselves and maybe give their partners a little bit more flexibility on the quote unquote this year deadline, since we're getting so close to the end of 2014. But hopefully those partners will get online in early 2015. And I hope Apple works really, really hard to continue to add more people, because again, like I said before, I love Apple Pay and I want to be able to use it more and more places. I ask all the time, and that's something I would encourage all of us to do. I think the more you ask at a retailer, can I use Apple Pay, the more that they hear it, the more pressure consumers are going to put on those companies to bring online support for it. And I think that's the best mechanism that we have. So if we do that on the front end and Apple's working hard on the back end to push it out, I think it will become more and more ubiquitous. And I think we talked last time the fact that Apple is pushing to roll out Apple Pay in more countries. It looks like they're working on a big push for Europe, and they're also pushing into China. No word on when exactly that will happen, but hopefully that will happen very soon. It'd be great if it would be in early 2015, but Apple hasn't given us any kind of firm date on any of that yet. And then finally, in the news for this week, a little security update to let you know about. Actually, you may already have been alerted to it, but Apple pushed out a security update for OS X Yosemite, Mavericks, and Mountain Lion to users to address a security flaw in the Network Time Protocol service, the NTP service. The issue was originally discovered by Google's security team about a week ago, so Apple jumped very quickly to actually roll out this fix. The vulnerability had the potential to allow an attacker to execute arbitrary code. They could do this by triggering a buffer overflow using the privileges of the Network Time Protocol daemon, the NTPD. Now, in rolling out this fix, Apple did something unique that it hadn't done before, which was push it out without requiring any kind of user intervention or action. So it wasn't the kind of thing where you got a notification and said, hey, you need to run your software update. They actually just pushed the update out. And I think on my computer, I just got a notice that said the security update had been applied. And I didn't realize it, but I guess Apple introduced this technology for doing automatic security updates about 2 years ago in OS X, but they had never used it before. So this past week was the first time that they had ever used it. And a spokesman for Apple, Bill Evans, said that the update is seamless and it doesn't even require a restart. So they just went ahead and pushed it out to everybody. And we're all more secure for it, I guess. So I don't know. Is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Do you like Apple being able to just sort of reach out and push security updates to you? Considering some of their past history with certain updates, I'm a little leery about it, I think. You know, I would worry about it a little bit. But I guess if it's benign enough and small enough, and it sounds like if this has been around for 2 years and Apple hasn't used it, that they're even being cautious about when they actually choose to sort of use this feature. So maybe it's not a big deal. I don't know. If you want to give me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Drobo. Drobo is a safe, expandable, simple storage array that you can get for your Mac. It's actually a product that I use and love. I use it, and we've talked about this in the past. I use it for a lot of my archive data. So when I need to get files off of my main hard drive and store them for long-term usage, I use my Drobo. I also use it for some Time Machine backups, things like that. And it's really great. What I love about it is the flexibility, the ability to get in there and to be able to expand and manage it. You can put in multiple drives, and so you automatically have a failover. So if one drive fails, your data is still protected. You can increase your storage at any time, either by adding a new drive to the Drobo or upgrading an existing one. So maybe you have an older drive and it's 1 terabyte. You want to swap it out for a 3 terabyte. You can do that and just gain the added storage capacity. So it's very, very flexible. And lights right on the unit let you know about the status of your drive. So it'll show if you're filling up your drives, when you need to start to think about buying another drive and adding more storage, or if you have a failure, it'll let you know that you need to replace a drive. And that actually happened to me. And what was awesome was it wasn't a stressful experience. I woke up, there was a red light on the Drobo indicating I needed to replace a drive, that one had failed, but all my data was still maintained because it was in the storage array and it had the failover. So all I had to do was go out, get a new drive, and pop it in there. And they have a whole range of products for you to use, desktop and mobile solutions, in different capacities. So they have 4, 5, and 8-bay drives. Their most recent model, their 4-bay model, they just did an update. They're now on their 3rd generation, and it's new and improved. It's faster. It's better. It has a USB 3.0 connection. Storage Review actually clocked that USB 3 connection, and they rated transfer speeds up to 200 megabytes per second. So it's blazing fast. It's got a new dual-core processor in there, making it 3 to 5 times faster than the older model. And it has a bunch of other cool features like additional redundancy. If you want to have 2-drive failover, you can do that in the latest Drobo. It has Time Machine support. It has an internal battery backup and an SSD cache so that even if the power goes out, you're going to be protected from failures. And best of all, that Drobo now starts at a low price, just $349 US, which is an amazing price for an expandable storage array. And here's the good news. Because you're a MacCast listener, you can get a Drobo at an even more discounted price, but you're going to have to act quickly. From now until December 29th, you can use the offer code HOLIDAYADAM, that's H-O-L-I-D-A-Y, Adam, at drobostore.com, and you can get $90 off a Gen 3 Drobo, a Drobo 5D, or a Drobo 5N. So use that offer code at drobostore.com and do it quickly and get your Drobo before the end of the year. Or if you're feeling lucky and you think you might want to try to win a Drobo, we're doing a little contest, a little giveaway. Drobo.com/MacCast. Go there before midnight, December 31st, and register in the sweepstakes to win a Gen 3 Drobo. And you'll be notified of that early in the new year if you're the winner. And a big thank you to Drobo for their support of the MacCast. You can get more information and details over at Drobo.com. Last episode, we had a listener who had visited a legitimate website and was suddenly getting a pop-up alert box that was asking him to call a 800 number. It basically said that malicious software had been detected and he needed to call this 800 number to fix it up. And then it also loaded a page in the background on the website that looked like a Google Chrome or a Google warning page saying that the site had been compromised and that his computer had been compromised and, you know, all those things that these phishing scams will try and do. But the problem was is that the little JavaScript pop-up, in essence, DOS did a denial of service attack on his Safari because he had the feature turned on that would relaunch the app with the tabs open. That's part of OS X. You can now, when you quit an app, have it open up with the Windows, the same Windows open that you had up prior to quitting the app. And we talked about how to turn that feature off in the last episode and sort of get out of this DOS situation. But when I was talking about that, my theory was that likely what happened, because it was coming from a legitimate website, was that there was some JavaScript injected, possibly by a banner ad, because so many websites now use these sort of banner ad services. So they contract with a company, the company just gives them some code, they load on the page, and then ads get inserted. And it could be Google, it could be, there's lots of these ad networks. And then they sell the ads, they insert the ads onto the pages of all these sites, and you don't really know where the ads are coming from. So every once in a while, some malicious code will slip in into an ad and cause maybe something like this to happen. It's kind of like adware to a certain degree, but it's coming through a legitimate site. And it could have also been that the legitimate site had been hacked in some way and somehow the code was put into their server. But either way, I didn't think it was the kind of instance where his particular machine was compromised and there was actually adware or spyware on his computer. But a couple of you emailed me, and I think rightly so, to say that could very possibly be the case. And yeah, it could. It just didn't sound like it in this situation. But at the very least, I thought we should follow up and probably talk about that, because one of those people that emailed me was Beans, and he said that he had a friend who had a similar experience lately, and it turned out to be that adware was on the computer. So you got a pop-up. It alerted them to call an 800 number for support. And I also had another friend of mine just email me today, same thing on his computer. It was saying call Apple support at an 800 number. And Apple would never really do that. And actually, no legitimate company would actually pop up a little alert box in your Safari browser and tell you to call an 800 number. So whatever you do, if you see one of these, don't call it. I don't know if there's a rash of this going around or what exactly is happening. But if you see one of these, definitely do not call it. But it could be that these are being popped up and triggered by adware that might be on your Mac. And that was what was happening in Beans' case. And so Beans actually pointed me to a pretty helpful article on Apple's support website that covers specifically how to deal with adware. And I will have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But I thought we'd cover some of the things that you should do in case you actually see this. And Apple calls it ad injection software in their support article. And it's basically advertising supported software that can come from third-party download sites. And some people install this legitimately because it's like an offer or a deal sort of thing. And it's supposed to, I guess, watch your browsing history and pop this stuff up. But at the end of the day, a lot of it's annoying. A lot of it is, so some can be legit, I guess, is the thing that I want to point out. Some people will actually install this on purpose. Other times it is installed through some other app, and then it puts this little background app in place and starts popping up these windows with ads and graphics while you're surfing the web. And it can do this even if you have the block pop-up windows option selected in Safari or whatever your browser of choice is. So it can be really annoying. And here's kind of some ways you can deal with it. The first thing that you probably want to do is check your browser preferences, check the extension settings, and make sure that only the extensions that you think should be installed are. And also just see if you don't have some of these kind of ad injection, adware extensions in there. And if you do, uninstall them. So that's Safari preferences extensions. And you can just hit the, you know, select the item and hit the little uninstall button for anything that you don't use anymore or don't want in there and take those out of there. I'm going to cover the tips for Safari. Other browsers have similar mechanisms, right? You can go into Chrome and add or remove extensions. You can go into Firefox and add and remove plugins. The concept's the same, so just adjust accordingly for your browser of choice. But some examples of ad injection extensions or software, just in case you don't know what these are or haven't seen any of them, Amazon Shopping Assistant by Spigot Inc. And Spigot Inc. seems to be a big source of this kind of adware stuff. And once again, I think these are legitimate apps that people sometimes install, and they're supposed to give you offers and things like that, but you don't realize what you're installing is actual adware. So they also have one called eBay Shopping Assistant. There's one called Search Me, Slick Savings by Spigot Inc. So those are all Spigot. Then there's another site called GoPhoto.it, GoPhoto.it, and then also Omnibar. And I think I've seen Omnibar on people's computers before. Again, I think it's one of these sort of browser toolbars, but then it also installs this adware, ad injection software. And those specific ones are examples of extensions. There is also specific apps that you may have installed that add in ad injection software. And these are particularly nasty because they can embed themselves kind of deep inside the OS. They use launch daemons or Symbol, which is simple bundle loaders, or maybe even kernel extensions, K-text files, and things like that to get deep down into your system. And removing them can be really, really tricky. Some examples of this are apps called Downlight, or it's also known as vSearch. There's also Conduit, which is also known as Trovi or MyBrand or Search Protect, which sounds like it should be protecting you from this stuff, right? I mean, that's how bad this stuff gets. And then there's also Genio, a.k.a. Install Mac. If you have any of these applications installed, there are specific instructions for each one and how to remove them in that Apple support article. They go, like I said, very deep, so you're going to have to get in and remove extension files. You're going to have to remove launch daemons and things like that and go into very deep specific folders within the system to get them out of there. And manually, I think, is really the best way to remove these because you know you're going to go in there and you're going to get all the little bits and pieces and you'll know that they get out. There are some apps out there that will scan for adware and offer removal help as well. I've used some in the past. Specifically, I've used one called MacScan. There's also Bitdefender, but I can't vouch for either of them at this point because I haven't used them in a while and I don't know where they're at. But they might be worth looking into, which is why I would mention them. But personally, I'd opt for looking for a manual method of removal so that you know what you're removing and what you're taking out of your system and things like that. Because like I said, these things go pretty deep. So that's kind of how you can locate, find, and remove this stuff. But, you know, where do you go from here? How do you make sure that this stuff doesn't happen to you, that you don't even get it on your machine in the first place? And the first and foremost thing is always be careful about what you're installing. Make sure that you're getting your software and things from first party, you know, directly from the developer or through the Mac App Store. And, you know what's going on with your system. To get as deep as these apps do, they still need permission. You know, the operating system, OS X, has a lot of controls and restrictions in place that protect you from these sorts of installs. So they are going to pop up and ask for admin credentials to install themselves. They're going to ask for permission. Like I said, a lot of them disguise themselves as sort of like, oh, you're going to get these great deals and offers. But when you see that, that should raise a red flag. You should question that and do a little bit of research. Do a little bit of Googling. Find out, is this a legitimate app? Does it have an adware element to it that I just don't know about? You know, they're not going to broadcast that they're doing this sort of stuff. So you got to find out for yourself. And just make sure you read all the dialog boxes when something pops up, you know, that's an installer and asks specifically for permission. It says, can I install this? Make sure you read what the application is and what it's trying to do. And if you don't understand it, again, Google. A little bit of Googling can help really protect you a lot from this sort of stuff. There are a few other protections that you can take, specifically inside Safari. If you go into Safari Preferences General, make sure that you uncheck the open safe files after downloading option. This means if you accidentally download an installer or something from Safari, accidentally click on something, it's not going to automatically pop up and start trying to install. Also in Safari Preferences under the Security tab, make sure the block pop-up windows is checked and that the warn when visiting fraudulent websites is checked. Because then if you go to a website that might potentially contain something that's malicious, it's going to warn you. Now, with the adware, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of it can get around the block pop-up windows thing, but at least in other instances, if it's just, you know, on the web, you're gonna potentially protect yourself from additional pop-up windows and things like that. And then also in Safari preferences under privacy, you may want to go through and take a look at your cookies and just make sure that the cookies and things that are installed, website data that's installed, is stuff that you really want on your machine. So if you go under cookies, you'll see a little details button. It's under the cookies and other website data section. And you can kind of clean up any cookies and data that you don't want. You, of course, could use the remove all website data option, but that could remove cookies and data that you actually do want on your system. So if you go into the little details area, it will show you each website that has installed cookies or data or information on your computer, and you can select ones individually and remove the data, just the data for that website. And it's amazing what you'll find in there if you just do a little bit of looking. So clean that stuff up, and that can help a little bit. Another thing that is a recent development with OS X and Safari that a lot of people don't realize isn't really spam or adware or anything like that is web push notifications. So a number of websites can now offer up push notifications, and those notifications will show up in your notification center. It can show up as dialogues and things like that. So if you've ever been to a website and a little panel comes down and it says, hey, this website would like to send you push notifications. Do you want to allow it? If you just don't read that and you click through and you hit allow, then you're going to have a notification for that website, and you could suddenly start getting information and offers and all kinds of alerts and not really realize that you had opted into that stuff. So if you go into Safari preferences under notifications, you'll see all of the websites that have asked, and it'll show you allow or disallow, I think. I can't remember the two columns. But if you've ever allowed one, you can go back in and disallow it if you don't want to be bothered by that. And if you don't want to be asked at all in the future, if you just want to, you know, by default, opt out of any push notification a website might want to send you, there is a checkbox that says allow websites to ask permission to send push notifications. If you uncheck that, then you won't be bothered by that stuff anymore. Few other last little protections. Don't run your main account as an administrator account. I know we've talked about this in the past when we've brought up security on the Mac, but if you go into System Preferences, Users and Groups, take a look at your account, see if it's an admin account, and you might consider switching it over. So if you're going to do that, what you're going to want to do is add a new account, make that account administrator. So, you know, call it My admin or whatever username you want to give it that you're going to remember, but something that lets you know, hey, this is the admin account. Set up a good, strong password for that admin account that's not the same as your user password, so make sure you do that. And then once you've set up that new admin account, you can go back into your user account and uncheck the allow user to administer this computer option to turn that back into a standard user account. And the only difference is when you're running a standard user account is you're going to be asked a little bit more frequently when you need to do things that require heightened permissions to log in as an administrator. And then you just put in the account information, the username and password for that administrator account you set up. But just leave that as a separate account. And the reason you do that is because that way, if you somehow install an app under your user account, it can't automatically sort of escalate up into that higher level permissions and potentially, you know, do damage on your system or install itself deeper, those sorts of things. And then one other thing you might consider is changing your domain name service provider from the one that your ISP uses, your internet service provider uses. So typically that's going to be your cable company or your DSL company. Change it to a service like OpenDNS. And all you have to do for that is go into your system preferences, into your network settings, and then click on the advanced button. And then under TCP/IP, you will see you can, not under TCP/IP, under DNS. Go under DNS, you can click the little plus button, and you can add domain name servers to use. And those will be used, the ones that you have in the system preferences, will be used before the ones that are provided by your router. You could also change these settings in your router. If you have an airport, there's a way to go into the airport and put in the DNS settings that you want to use, and you can put the ones in for OpenDNS. But I think, you know, it's easier and quicker to do it right in the network settings on your Mac. And if you use a service like OpenDNS or maybe even Google DNSs, they have blocking tools and scans on the DNS side to protect you from malicious sites. So they maintain lists of known malicious sites and will automatically block those or redirect you away from those and warn you so that you don't accidentally end up on those sites. Because it happens from time to time. You fat finger a URL or something like that, you could end up on a site that you really don't want to be on. And having a service like OpenDNS will help protect you from that. So those are all things that you can do to better protect yourself from malware and more specifically spyware, adware, those sorts of things. Listener Mustafa emailed me this week and asked a great question about something that I had never really thought about, but after he asked the question, it made a lot of sense to me. He asked about setting up an iOS alarm that would allow the phone to just vibrate when the alarm went off and not make any noise so as not to disturb anybody around you. So by default, alarms in iOS will make noise even if the device is on silent. You know, you flip the little switch and it's in the silent mode, vibrate only mode, and even if do not disturb is turned on. And if you think about it, at first that seems wrong, but if you think about it, it does make sense, because if you set an alarm, say a wake up alarm for the morning or something like that, you want to make sure that it goes off and that you can hear it. But after I received the email, it made sense, because there are those situations where, yes, I want to set an alarm. I want to be alerted to something at a specific time, but I don't want to have any noise. I need to be discreet about it. So maybe you're going into a business meeting. Maybe you're going to, you know, you're going to be at a show, but you want an alarm still set. So the question is, how can we set an alarm and not have it make any noise, but still vibrate? And the first thing that I did is I popped into the clock application in iOS and thought, there's got to be a way to do this. And I scrolled all the way down to the bottom, and sure enough, when you're in the, sorry, I went into the sound section for setting up an alarm. So when you add an alarm, there's a sound setting. Went in there and I scrolled all the way to the bottom, and right at the bottom, there was a none option. And I thought, eureka, I found it. Just set it to none and you should be good to go. Well, unfortunately, when I went to test it, yes, you can choose that as the option. The alarm will go off. It will display the alarm pop-up, letting you know that you have an alarm, but it doesn't play a sound, which is great, but the thing is it doesn't vibrate either. So none actually means it's not going to do anything other than display a pop-up, which is completely useless unless you have your phone right in front of you and you're looking at the screen. So that certainly wasn't going to work for Mustafa. So I thought a little bit more on this, and I thought, well, you know what? Here's the solution. What if you just had a silent ringtone? And that is a total dichotomy. I totally get that. Doesn't make any sense, but have a silent ringtone, and then you could just set that as the alarm tone, and then it should still vibrate, but you'll get no noise. And that's easy enough to do because we have GarageBand, and GarageBand makes it really easy to create ringtones. So all you have to do is go into GarageBand, open up a new project, create a loops project. Call it something like silent alarm or silent ringtone, whatever you want to name it, so you're going to recognize it when you get it over to your iOS device. And then in GarageBand, just add a new no effects track. So if you go under the track menu, you can create a new basic track that's going to have no effects or anything like that. And then at the bottom of the screen, you're going to want to turn on the cycle region, the loop region. There's a little button. It looks like two arrows kind of going around, almost looks like a loop button. And click on that, or I guess it technically is a loop button, really, but click on that, and then in the LCD, right to the left of that, make sure that you've changed from showing measures to amount of time in the LCD window. And then back in your track, now that you have the cycle region turned on or the loop region turned on, you'll see the little yellow loop bar. You can grab the handle on there and extend it out to about 10 seconds. We'll create a 10-second no sound ringtone. And then set the playhead at the beginning and just press record and record 2 to 5 seconds of nothing, you know, just being as quiet as possible. So if you have your input set to say, the built-in mic on your Mac. You don't want to have any sound going at this point. But it doesn't even matter if you capture some sound, because we're actually going to reduce the volume down to nothing. So record a couple seconds and then put the cursor up near the recorded track near the top right corner, and you should see the cursor icon turn into a little circular loop cursor icon. When you see that, click and drag and extend that silence loop out to about 10 second mark. And then you can drag the track volume slider for that track all the way to the left, down to minus 144 dB, which is in essence going to be silence, and then save the track, and then under the share menu, choose the send ringtone to iTunes option. So that will export your new silent ringtone, send it over to iTunes. Then you can dock in your phone or your iPad, whatever you want to sync the tone over to, and then select your device inside iTunes, click on the tones tab or the tones section, and just make sure that you sync over your new silent alarm tone. Once, and then hit apply, that should start the sync process. Go ahead and sync the new tone over to your device. And now when you go into the clock application and you set up your alarm, you should be able to pick your new silent alarm tone from the sound settings. And when it goes off, it will still vibrate and display the alert. But since the tone that's playing has no sound, you'll have complete silence as your alarm goes off. So that's what I suggested to Mustafa. If all of this seems too complex to you, if you don't want to have to be bothered with making your own silent alarm ringtone, there actually are ones you can find and download online. I did a quick search for iOS silent ringtone on Google, and I found several options. So you could simply download one of those ringtone files, and then again, load it into iTunes and sync it over your device. Same kind of thing. And that is the best way I could think to do it. Maybe there's another way to set up vibrating-only alarms. Maybe some third-party apps allow you to do it. I'm almost positive there are probably some third-party apps that allow you to do it. But if you want to do it with the built-in application, this was the only way that I could figure out how to do it. And then finally, in the MacCast for this week, this is a very actually timely thing for us to talk about, because Eric had a great question for me about giving iTunes items as gifts. So you may or may not be aware, but if you go into iTunes, if you go into the iTunes store, when you're looking at an item, and it could be an app, it could be a TV show, it could be a movie, it could be a bit of music, next to the purchase button, the buy button, there's a little drop down. And if you click on that, you can actually send any individual item as a virtual gift or a digital gift. So this is not like just a gift card. This is actually saying, I'm going to give you this specific song or this specific album or this specific book, whatever it might be. And more these days around the holiday season, especially if you're like me and or a little bit of a procrastinator, you may need to send friends and family virtual gifts so that they get there on time, right? So you're sitting around Christmas Eve. Oh my gosh, I forgot cousin John and I want to send him something. So you go into iTunes because you know he has an iPad and you send him that cool app that that you've been playing around with. But what Eric wanted to know is what happens if you gift someone something that they already own? Because if you've ever received an iTunes gift, what you know is you get a little email alert, and then you basically get a redemption code, right? So you click on the link, it redeems the code, and it puts it into your iTunes account. But what happens if you already own the thing that someone gifted you, or you send a gift to someone and they already own it? And I really had no idea what would happen, but I guess when you start to think about it, you assume some things, right? So I made some assumptions, and I thought, well, you know, maybe when you go to make the purchase, one of the things you have to do is enter the person's email address to send the gift to. Maybe it checks to see, hey, is this email registered with Apple? Is there an Apple ID associated with this email? And if there is, check and make sure that that person that's going to be receiving the gift doesn't already own the item. If they do, warn the person that's purchasing the gift, hey, they already own that item. Maybe you want to pick something else. It seemed like a logical thing to me. Another thing I thought is, well, maybe if you send a duplicate item and the person attempts to redeem it into their account, it will notice that and then just simply give them iTunes credit, right? Give them a 99-cent credit, or if you sent them a $20 movie, they get $20 of iTunes credit, and then they can use it to buy whatever they want, something that they don't own. Another logical way to kind of handle that, right? So there's several ways you can handle this, or at the very least, you would think, hey, if I go to try and redeem my gift for something that I already own, it's a duplicate, it will alert the sender, and then the sender could maybe re-gift that item to someone else or get a refund. I don't know. But it, you know, maybe notify them, hey, so-and-so tried to redeem your gift. They already owned this. They have that. Would you like to send them something else? Great way to handle that. So, thought any one of those things. Well, guess what? Actually happens. Because I tested this. I tested this with a song and an app. I sent it to a friend. We actually coordinated on this. I was doing a little, you know, journalistic investigation. And turns out what happened was when I sent the song, they not only were able to redeem it, but they ended up with two of the exact same track in their iTunes library. And I think it might have been in different formats, because I think the one version may have been purchased before Apple removed DRM. So you had a protected AAC and then a non-protected, non-DRM'd AAC. But regardless, same track in their music library twice, which made no sense because they actually owned the whole album. So now they had duplicates of track one. Totally dumb. Then we thought, well, let's try with an app and see what happens. Well, sure enough, it let them redeem the app. Now, that this time they didn't end up with two copies of the app. It just let them redeem it. It let them download the whole entire app. I'm assuming it replaced the app version that they had already downloaded that was already there. But no other warning, no other indication that now you have two copies. So I don't know if they internally in Apple system now have two licenses or even how that works. But regardless, did not give any notification to the purchaser of the gift nor the receiver of the gift that there was any kind of duplicate. So after this whole thing happened, I did email iTunes store support. I've asked, hey, what's the deal here? How do I get a refund? What's going on? Is there a way to fix this situation? I did that 4 days ago. I know it's the Christmas holidays, so maybe it'll take longer for them to get back to me, but I have not had any response from iTunes support. And after all of this, I think this is the most stupid thing, although very typical of Apple and iTunes, unfortunately. And I should have known, you know, I gave you those scenarios which I thought, you know, is the way it should be handled. But I should know that, of course, this isn't the way that they handled it. But in a way, this feels like Apple is really deceiving or almost stealing from people, because I'm out 99 cents. Had I not been doing this with my friend, if they didn't come back and say, hey, I redeemed your gift, but I already owned that, you know, so you need to go request a refund. If I didn't know to go request a refund, you know, they're just getting extra money. So they're double dipping. They're double selling items in a lot of cases. And I have to wonder, you know, this could be happening thousands, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of times, that's a lot of extra free revenue for Apple, where they're not delivering any extra goods or anything more to their consumers for those dollars. And that's really a pretty bad thing. So I think I'm going to continue to follow up on this stuff. The one thing I will note is another thing that they could have done to handle this is not allow the redemption to go through, because I did notice that if I went into my iTunes store account, so if you go into iTunes, into the store and click on accounts and then log in, under your purchase history, there is a manage gifts option. And if the person that you sent the gift to has not redeemed it yet, you do have the ability to change the recipient email. So you could change it and resend the gift. But once they've actually clicked on the link and clicked redeem in the iTunes store, it can no longer be re-gift or refunded or anything like that. So just the fact that iTunes allows someone to redeem a duplicate item, an item that they already own, is where the root of the problem seems to be. But they could be handling this so much more elegantly. And Eric, that's, you know, basically what I discovered with this stuff. So the best thing you can do is tell your friends and relatives, if I send you a gift from iTunes and you already own it, please don't redeem it. actually email me back and let me know so that I can at least gift it to someone else. I don't think you can get a refund, so you'd have to go back and purchase them something different or gift them something different. You'd still have your original gift sitting around in your iTunes account, but at least you could maybe send it to another member of your family or a friend, somebody who doesn't own that item, and at least not be out your money that way. But we'll see. I'll try to follow up when I hear back from Apple. I'm also planning, I think, to send an email to Apple PR. I just haven't had time to do that yet. I'll send an email to Apple PR and see if they don't have a response or something to say about this. And I will follow up on a future episode of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices. You can find out more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. MacCast listeners can get a free trial of Lynda's service by going to lynda.com/MacCast. to sign up. And a big thank you to Lynda and all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them at backbeatmedia.com. Always love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can email me, MacCast@gmail.com. If you'd like to send audio comments, I very much welcome those. You can also leave an audio comment on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode, you can find those on the website. That's at MacCast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we also have a MacCast Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. And then I have just one more item for you before we close up today, and that is some new music. This was a feature of the MacCast that we had for years. We kind of stopped doing it because, frankly, it got pretty hard for me to go out every week and actually find new pod-safe music, basically music that I was authorized to play for you. So I think a month or so ago, we played a new track from one of my favorite bands called the Young Dubliners. They just produced their own album. They've been around for years, but this latest album they did all on their own, and they said I could play you a track off of that. And at that time, I said, hey, if anybody else out there has some music and you can give me the rights and permission to actually play a track on the MacCast, I'd like to kind of bring this feature back a little bit so that we can give back a little bit to those folks in our community who are music producers or creators and things like that. So today's track came from Keith. He's the bass player for the band Bartley Norton and 64 Highway. It's a country song, and I'm not the biggest country fan. It's not normally my style, but I liked his music, and I know there's many people who are fans. So the music can be found on iTunes. They're also in Spotify. So if you like the band, support them by buying their music via iTunes or adding it to your Spotify playlist. And you can get more information and buy their music also on their website, which is 64 Highway. That's the number 64highway.com. And again, if you have a band and a song you think that we'd like on the MacCast, please email me, shoot me the audio file, and just let me know that I have permission to play it. Not everything will get played, but I'll try to do my best to share the favorites, and maybe we can bring back some of this new music here on the MacCast. But for today, I have Nothing I Don't Love by Bartley Norton and 64 Highway. Enjoy, and I will talk to you all again real soon.
I've been up late racking my brain. I've been trying to think for days. There's just gotta be something to complain about. This can't really be as good as it seems. Maybe someone's gonna shake me out of this dream. Maybe I should just quit trying to figure it out. There's nothing I don't love. Come a day when I won't want to wake up and find you in my arms. Oh, when you breathe my name, it thrills me. When you walk away, it kills me. Every part of you, every single thing you do just lights me up. Baby, there's nothing I don't love. You sing with your headphones on, and now you always get the words all wrong. It don't matter, baby, your song still moves me. The way you laugh at your own bad jokes, stay up all night drinking coffee and coke. Ain't nobody ever done what you do to me. There's nothing I don't love about you. There's no way I could live without you. There'll never come a day when I won't want to wake up and find you in my arms. When you breathe my name, it thrills me. When you walk away, it kills me. Every part of you, every single thing you do just lights me up. Nothing I don't love. Nothing I don't love about you, baby. Nothing at all.